Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, it's the holiday season, so oh what fun it is to offer you this moment in time when renowned sex advice columnist Dan Savage met renowned sex therapist Esther Perel for an extremely frank discussion of marriage and infidelity. There's really nothing quite like it that I've heard.
If my mother knew I'm having these conversations.
Let's see if they put this on NPR.
If you're curious about the challenges of modern couples facing infidelity issues, buckle up for a great discussion. Esther Perel is the author of The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. She hosts the podcast, Where Should We Begin? Dan Savage is the editorial director of The Stranger and the host of Savage Lovecast. They spoke at Seattle's Egyptian Theater on October 12th. Sonia Harris recorded their talk. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're posting our podcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
Hey, everybody. Can you hear me? Am I on? Welcome. If you've been to live tapings of the Savage Lovecast in the past, they're usually big extravaganzas. We usually have drag queens and strippers and performers. But not tonight, not at this live taping of the Savage Lovecast. I'm very sorry to say, actually. Tonight, we're doing something a little differently. We have a very special conversation tonight with Esther Perel. Esther, Esther Perel's first book, Mating in Captivity, was an international bestseller. It was translated to 29 languages, and it established Esther as one of the most insightful and original voices on modern love, and it instantly made me an enormous fan, and I am so excited to have her here tonight. Esther is a psychotherapist with a private practice in New York City. Her TED Talks, which I hope you've watched, have been viewed more than 20 million times. She is also the host of the Audible original series, Where Should We Begin?, which is fascinating listening. It is now available in podcast form. Go get it. And we are here tonight to talk about and celebrate her second book, The State of Affairs, Rethinking Infidelity. Please welcome to the stage and welcome to Seattle, Esther Perel. We have champagne to celebrate. Writing a book is a pain in the fucking ass, so when you finish the book, you get to celebrate writing that book. So we wanted to have a little champagne.
Thank you.
Although we're going to have to be careful, because tonight is being taped for broadcast on KUOW, so I can't get too drunk, because then I'll start throwing F-bombs around. And we can't have that. Cheers. Congratulations. The book is terrific. Did they have champagne for you at the 95th Street Y or whatever that is?
92nd Street Y? No, it's a serious place.
Okay, good. So what inspired you to follow up Mating in Captivity about really sex and long-term relationships and making that work? With a book on a topic that is just so explosive and controversial, a topic that you're not allowed to bring nuance to. You bring nuance to the topic in this book, I think at great risk.
Let me ask something to all of you, and I'll probably start the answer. If I asked you, how many of you have been affected by the experience of infidelity in your life? Raise your hand. In one way or another, in one position, as the child of, the friend of, the person in the triangle. I began to go around and ask this question, and many, many times, it's about 80% of the people raised their hand. And so I'm thinking, here is this experience that can shake the foundation of an entire relationship. shatter the trust, the intimacy, the whole thing, has been ubiquitous, has existed since marriage was invented, and is often so poorly understood. And the dialogue about it is often quite polarizing, judgmental, shaming, secrecy. I mean, the whole thing itself is shrouded in secrecy and shame, and we can do better. We just need to do better to help the people who are experiencing this thing. And that was what motivated me. And then I'm not known for going for easy topics.
And we should do better on this topic. Why?
Because a lot of people are in pain, because it's passed on intergenerationally, because it affects the way that we love and are loved, because it has been historically and notoriously a complete gender unequal proposition. This is about power. This is about sexual politics. This is about male privilege. This is not the same story for men and women or for gay couples and straight couples. I mean, to just think of it in this narrow, you know, lens is not enough. And then because I think that we need an approach that is more caring and more compassionate so that we can have a new model for the oldest sin.
It is about power, and I think some of the best evidence that it was about power is the evening out of infidelity rates between men and women. Historically, men cheated at much greater rates, had more license to cheat. They also had less at risk from cheating. They were less vulnerable than women were, mm-hmm. economically. As women have become earners, and having their own careers, having their own jobs, having their own incomes, you've seen with, I think it's people under 40, Hannah Rosen wrote about this in The End of Men, that women are cheating at the same rate that men are, which is just, I think, the clearest evidence that cheating, adultery, was always about power, and male privilege was tied to that power, and it facilitated sort of male license. It wasn't that women were less interested in cheating or less capable of cheating, they were just more vulnerable to the fallout from an adulterous affair.
So there has always been a double standard. Historically, monogamy was primarily an imposition on women for economic reasons, in order to know whose children I should feed and who gets the cows when I die. Or the goats or the camels, because this traveled across the cultures.
Or the kingdom.
And it's not just the economic. The most important thing that changed is contraception. As long as the threat of infidelity was a child, and a child with a color hair that was different from yours, that was the beginning of the threat. So you had pregnancy, child mortality, destitution, and ostracism. Women belonged to men. They would be left with nothing, not even themselves, because they were completely shamed. So the consequences have always been a lot more dire for women. And 9 countries today still kill women if they stray. This is absolutely not an equal story. And now, yes, women are closing the infidelity gender gap. Why? Because they have a car, like within Saudi Arabia. They finally have a car. They can leave the house. So we don't have a clue what women want and what women will do, because we've never given them the opportunity to know. And it was never called cheating, by the way. Men were doing what it was called being a man. Let's be very clear. There was from there to Weinstein, there's like a long way to go, you know? And then, you know, people had all kinds of very juicy theories to justify why it's in the nature of men to roam. Men are not by nature monogamous. Men are conquistadors. They're natural roamers. Who knows? You know? But it's changed, and it means that the risks are less for women. They have a growing economic independence. They have more mobility. The consequences are less dire. And if the consequences change, then it challenges one of the fundamental stereotypic thinking that men cheat, stray, because they like novelty, because they get bored, because they like variety, whereas women cheat because they are lonely and hungry for intimacy. You bet, if the consequences are severe, you better be really miserable and lonely and hungry before you take the chance. But we don't know what she would do if the consequences were the same.
I've often, I've said, and I believe that There was this moment when straight people redefined marriage. During the whole debate about same-sex marriage, you kept hearing from religious conservatives and some scaredy-cat straight people that gay people wanted to redefine marriage. And the actual truth was that straight people had redefined marriage already to the point where you could make a logical argument to exclude same-sex couples from the institution of marriage as straight people recreated and practiced it. A marriage is whatever the two people in it say that it is. A marriage is as egalitarian or as power imbalanced as any couple decides to make it. It's not a gendered institution anymore. And when marriage became egalitarian, when it became the union of two autonomous and equal individuals by free choice, rather than extending to women, in my reading, the same license that men had always enjoyed, we took back from men, we imposed on men the limitations women had always endured. That the monogamous expectation around, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years ago began to be imposed on men for the first time in history. And it seems to me, from my casual observations over 26 years of listening to people complain about their relationships, that was a disaster for marriage, that the shift should have been extending to women the same license and freedom that men had always enjoyed or exploited, rather than yanking back from men that freedom.
Because monogamy changed meaning. Because monogamy changed meaning. For most of history, monogamy had absolutely nothing to do with love. It was basically a structure that preserved the configuration of the family, the land, the children, the herds, the properties, the lineage. The Romantic ideal turned monogamy into the sacred cow, into the full expression of the uniqueness of love that has found the one and only. And at that point, if you bring egalitarian together, and now you make monogamy become the declaration of love, then both people are expected to do the same. And that's when you restrict it from men, but not because you restrict the freedom that they used to have. It's that both people are supposed to make that same declaration, which is that, you know, look, for most of history, people married and they had sex for the first time. Today, they marry and they stop having sex with others.
You've said monogamy used to mean one person for life. Now it means one person at a time.
Yes.
I'm quoting Esther Perel to Esther Perel.
Yes. No. People tell me all the time, I am monogamous in all my relationships. Makes perfect sense suddenly, right? It's like, you know, when this woman is like, I have been monogamous with my two husbands and my three boyfriends since. And it's like, this is an extraordinary new definition of monogamy, you know? So
it's one that pisses me off. Because as someone who's in a non-monogamous relationship, I've had this experience on multiple occasions where someone has said to me, I couldn't do what you and Terry do because I value love and commitment too highly. Terry, who I've been with for almost 25 years.
Right.
And the next thing out of their mouth is, all three of my marriages were monogamous.
Right.
And what they're committed to...
I quote you on that one.
Right. Thank you. What they're committed to is monogamy, not any of the fools that they marry. Which to me seems to put too much importance on monogamy, that monogamy is this talisman, this fetish object, this symbol of love and commitment. And if you fail at it, you failed at love and commitment.
But even more so now, even more so, monogamy defined as sexual exclusivity is even more intense today because it comes in the West. Look, in the West, in 1960, 80% of the people in their 20s were married. Today, it's 20% of the people in their 20s are married, which means that we don't have cornerstone marriages, we have capstone marriages. So you have 10 years, 20 years of sexual nomadism in which you can prolifically, you know, float around. And then you find that one and only.
And do you know what we call that 10, 20 years of sexual nomadism?
No, but you're going to tell me.
The gay lifestyle. Like, I think what we see now with straight people until 30, 35 is living the quote-unquote gay lifestyle
right.
that religious conservatives were freaking out about 50 years ago,
which is
not making a commitment, living in an urban area, having a lot of sex and a lot of sex partners. It's just straight people took the gay lifestyle and renamed everything. We had tricks, you have hookups, we had fuck buddies, you have friends with benefits. And now, I just think, I mean, this is a digression, but it's really interesting to see straight people leading the gay lifestyle, gay people leading the straight lifestyle. It just shows that there was nothing gay or straight about either
that's
of those
right,
lifestyles.
That's right. Very well put. And so imagine after that lifestyle, I now am going to change this completely around because I found the person. And that person chooses me at my essence. That person is the one for whom I can cure my case of FOMO.
You can what?
I can cure my FOMO. You know, I no longer have to think that I can do better. This is the person that has captivated my imagination. This is the person for whom I'm going to delete my apps. You know, you bet.
Or this is the person I'm going to tell I'm going to delete
yes,
my apps.
Yes. Do you understand what exclusivity means today is that I voluntarily choose to restrict myself, to no longer continue in the life that I have had. It is this most voluntary imposition of fidelity. And it has a complete different meaning from anything it ever had. You know, well, how do you go from this extreme, because if you want one more element of what gay, you know, influence was, is that it's not just hookup. It's also a kind of a race to the bottom of how meaningless could it be? Not...
I think I know a different class of bottom, but please continue. Like, I think I know what you mean. Like, how can I can have this as long as I don't get too invested or engaged?
Yes, yes. I don't want to get dependent. I don't want to get too committed. I don't want this to mean anything. I want to stay free.
Because I want to stay free. And if I make an emotional investment, that comes with obligations. If I use girlfriend
That's
or
right.
boyfriend, hence friends with benefits, hence hookup, hence all these new words and terms and definitions that hold people at a
That's
distance.
That's right. And then from there, I go to the soulmate. The soulmate, which is a phenomenal new concept, because it really is the conflation between the spiritual and the relational. It's for the first time, you know, when people used to say the one and only, they used to mean God. Now they mean my partner. And they want transcendence and ecstasy and meaning and wholeness and belonging from their partner. All things that we used to look for in the sanctuary of the divine. That person becomes one person for everything. That's why, and why am I saying this? Because you cannot understand modern infidelity without understanding modern love. Otherwise, you don't understand why it's become so shattering. It's always been painful. It never was that traumatic. It becomes traumatic when you become everything for me. When I get from you everything I used to get from traditional marriage, companionship, economic security, children maybe, family life, social respectability, and you are my best friend, my trusted confidant, my passionate lover, my intellectual equal, the best parent, the person who inspires me in my career. It's one person to give you what once an entire village used to provide. You know, when that person cheats on you and you thought you are so special, you bet you feel you're not. Otherwise, you cannot understand why infidelity has become the deal breaker and the leading cause of divorce in America.
So I'm wrong, because I believe, and I've said, I think 8,000 times a day into my podcast tape recording machine, that we experience infidelity as a relationship extinction level event because that's what we tell ourselves that it is, or that it must be experienced that way.
But we tell ourselves that because of the model that we're living in.
So what do we do? How do we walk back all of the crap we've heaped up, all the expectations, all the needs, all the affirmation that we've heaped up on one person who chose us? How do we get it back to the village or the bathhouse or wherever else we might get more support?
You get support in the bathhouse?
No. I've never actually dropped my pants in a bathhouse. I have this sort of hypersense of cooties, like I can't share a can of Coke with my sister. Like, putting a dick in my mouth that's been in 30 other mouths is just not a place I can go.
If my mother knew I'm having these conversations.
Let's see if they put this on NPR.
God.
little like cut here.
You forgot?
I did for a moment. So if I may rephrase my question. If we experience infidelity and adultery as shattering because what marriage now means is I am your one, you are my one, together we are this transcendent whole, and mm-hmm. you are where I experience divine, you're my best friend, and you're my lover, and my security, and my family, and da-da-da-da. How do we make infidelity, which is going to touch almost every truly long, long, long-term relationship, how do we make it less shattering? How do we walk it back?
So I'm going to do a little detour, because when I say shattering, I actually think there are three unique places where you can really see a new definition about the pain. It's a new meaning to the pain. The pain has always existed, and infidelity has existed throughout, for every model of marriage, for that matter. It just means something else. It shatters the grand ambition of love, meaning I'm not so special. But then it also shatters my identity. I thought I knew who I was. I thought I knew my life. I thought I knew who you were. And you, by doing this, are breaking the coherence of my life. I no longer know the story of my life. You know, it's one thing to not be sure about what's going to happen in the future. It's another thing to start questioning the past. You at least think you remember the past, but now you wonder if this was really this, and when we were sitting there, you were under the table doing something. You know, when you said this at my birthday, and you were calling, and everything gets redefined, and you don't trust, not just that you don't trust your partner, you no longer trust your own perception. And you don't trust yourself, because if you could have been so not aware of what was going on, what can you hold on to? And that's the feeling of the shattering. And your question is, there's two different questions, is how do we make this not be the end? No, don't do this to me.
Sorry. I don't want to drink alone.
You know, I mean, one thing is, for me, part of writing the book was, is that, assume this is what happens. Does that mean it has to be the end? Maybe sometimes it is. An affair will break the relationship. But sometimes it may also remake the relationship. And if so, how do people go about doing this? And more importantly, don't confuse the feelings of the affair or the infidelities with your feeling about the relationship. That I began to think because, you know, I could write about chronic philanderers. I could write about all kinds of people who do nasty stuff. But that wouldn't be so interesting because you expect it. You end up writing about the things that you research and that surprise you. Such as, I too began from this notion, this must happen in a relationship if there is some problems. Something must be missing or you wouldn't be going to look for it elsewhere. And then I began to realize that this is not what I was hearing. I was hearing people often tell me, I have a good relationship. We are together 17, 25, 32 years. We're not talking here about any, you know, repeat offenders of any kind. We're talking about very faithful people who've been monogamous their whole life, who often love their partners and their life, and tell you, I'm having an affair. I crossed the line that I never thought I would cross myself, that I would have been judgmental about before. I can't believe I'm doing this. And now begin unpack this whole thing. And that notion that not all affairs are the consequence of troubled relationships. Some of them have actually not much to do with the relationship at all.
It has to do with the individual?
It has to do with the individual. And all the time when you call it cheating, in a way, you don't allow for any of that unpacking to happen. And how do we do that without then being looked at as, oh, you're making excuses for the people who do transgress and betray, or you are condoning, or you are making light of it. But in fact, maybe it's not what one is doing. What one is really saying is transgression is a part of human nature, and we need to understand it, even its dark side. Affairs are always a dual perspective. It's what it does to you, the hurt, the betrayal, the deception, the lies, the secrecy, and what it means for me, which is sometimes about longing and loss and not wanting to leave you as much as I want to leave the person that I have become.
You write about non-monogamous relationships, and you point out, rightly so, that it is possible to cheat in an open relationship. And you describe situations where people in open relationships, you have cases, couples that you're working with, where one cheated. And you say, and I think it's really a brilliant insight, that it's not so much cheating, it's transgressing. That we as a species have this need to make rules and break rules. Mm-hmm. Is the solution then to make fewer rules? Attached to a relationship, not anything goes, not whatever you want, not there's no leash, but when I look at...
Do you know what is Jack Morin's famous erotic equation?
Mm-hmm.
Excitement is attraction plus obstacle. The obstacle is the rules. There is, first of all, no system without rules. Every organism, every organization, every relationship has rules. You can have different ones, you can have looser ones, you can have those that say you can do all of this, and then you will have the person who will go for the one little thing they were not supposed to do. You know, there is something that has to do with the power of transgression. Children know it very well, and they have that gleeful look at you because they just know that, that defiant look that says, I am doing what I want. Even when it's your own self-imposed rules, because many times it's nobody else put the rules on you. You created your life, you created your box. But there is something about breaking your own rules that is enormously powerful, generative, enlivening, and at the same time, destructive, painful, betraying, and violating. Both things are happening at the same time.
And sometimes people want to destroy. I call it slamming the hand down on the self-destruct button. There are people who cheat in a way because they want to get caught, because they want out, and they'll blow it all up. But sometimes people just want to feel like they almost blew it all up, because that helps them see with fresh eyes the thing that they almost destroyed, the thing that they almost lost, the thing that they risked. There are cases, I think, where people cheat, and then coming out of it, particularly if they don't get caught and they keep their mouth shut, they recommit in a way to the relationship with new eyes, with fresh eyes. They see everything that they shoved under the middle of the table and rolled the dice and almost lost, and value it again anew.
You know, one of the most interesting research, I've actually not talked much about that, but there's a whole field of research about edge behavior, edge psychology, people who do extreme sports and things like that. And there is an enormous amount of thinking that goes into that field that actually is part of the grandiosity that people experience when they are having affairs or transgressing. Because you do feel grandiose. Your rationalizations are always grandiose. They entitle you, they give you a reason why you deserve this, they give you an explanation for why this is the thing that you need to do right now. And it's one intricate web of justifications. Afterwards, you look at yourself and you can't believe you thought any of this. I was like, what was it? Like, how do we have a way to just, like,
I want to share a story
ensnare ourselves?
I want to share a paragraph in the book, because I think it's early in the book, but I think it's a paragraph that gets you in trouble, and I want you to talk about that kind of trouble. Because I believe that some good may come out of the crisis of infidelity, I have often been asked, so would you recommend an affair to a struggling couple? My response? A lot of people have positive life-changing experiences that come along with terminal illness, but I would no more recommend having an affair than I would recommend getting cancer. But in your practice, working with these couples, I've seen it too, sometimes the affair shakes things up and the couple is stronger and better after the affair. Mm-hmm. That the affair is this kind of winnowing. Some couples come through the affair and they're stronger and better. Some couples come through the affair and it's a detente without much love or peace. It's just a low simmering conflict, and they put it on the back burner and ignore it, and they're in denial about it. But some couples come through an affair renewed.
Can I read something?
Yes, of course.
That answers this?
While you...
We are talking about a book after all, so...
You were saying, like, give a rule to a child and you will see the child, like, violated in a small way. It reminded me, while you looked this up, of something my son once did. My son got 86 from a restaurant that we went to all the time when he was 4 years old, because he walked up to the cake cart and went to touch one of the cakes, and the owner of the restaurant said, don't touch the cake with your fingers. And he looked at the owner and licked the cake. I was so proud. But we all want to lick the cake at some point in our lives.
I mean, it's a powerful image. Look, there is in many areas, people will tell you that you learn from crisis, that you can turn the danger into an opportunity, that from betrayal, from the ashes, you come back to life, you build from the places that are the lowest. On this one, if you dare to say that actually some people can come out of this experience stronger, more honest, more resilient, and more thriving, it very quickly becomes, then you're saying that this is a good thing? It's like, how does it slip into a good thing? It's absolutely not a good thing. Nobody would ever recommend, and for that matter, humanity didn't wait for Esther Perel to cheat. Esther Perel wrote a book because so many people do it. No, this is like, who has that kind of a power? But this subject, if it is not condemned, then you are very quickly seen as condoning it. It is, the pull is towards black and white, victim and perpetrator, good and bad. And yet the dilemmas of desire are way more complicated than that, to be reduced into simple categorizations. And everybody knows that, that has been in this situation. Even the people who said, I catch you, you're dead, which is basically the extent of negotiation on monogamy in many straight couples, you know. And then when it happens, no, it's not so simple. You have a life together, you have a history together, you have maybe a family together, you have extended, to dismantle a relationship is to dismantle a whole network of connections. That is not always what people want to do. And what is happening today is that it used to be that divorce carried all the stigma and the shame, and now it's choosing to stay when you can leave is the new shame. So person after person sits in my office, you know, betrayed by their beloved and unable to talk about it with anybody else because they're going to be judged for being weak, for not throwing the dog on the curb, for letting themselves, you know, be walked over, and people will ostracize them for not standing up. And standing up means one thing only, is to get out.
And it's standing up not in defense of the relationship or even your own dignity, it's standing up in defense of monogamy. That monogamy is the ideal. Monogamy is the altar on which we will sacrifice everything.
That
you have to divorce your husband because he cheated on you, otherwise you don't value monogamy.
Or that this betrayal tops all others. And there is where some other honesty needs to come in. People know the relationships they've been having. People know, you know, that they may have been... I had a guy in my office, you know, he's like, you, with an S, you know, I at least have not been sleeping with other people, and he just goes at her and has been going at her for forever, you know, contempt, indifference, neglect. And I, at one point, really needed to say to him, you know, betrayal comes in many forms. I am really sorry. You know, you have society on your side. Because you did not have sex with somebody else, then you can have the moral superiority. But in my mind, I was thinking, maybe you didn't do it because you're not such a likable person. And, you know.
You couldn't trick a second person into taking you,
know,
you to bed.
But meanwhile, she's for the first time with someone who's actually kind, treats her well. She finds that she can, for the first time, talk and have been be listened to, and she's actually quite smart. And I'm thinking, you know, betrayal comes in many forms. And that's when I wrote that line that you always come back to. It's like, the victim of the affair is not always the victim of the marriage.
And you're not allowed to say that. And if you say
that... In my office, I say it. Because when I say it, it's because they know it. And if we're going to be honest, then we're going to be accountable. And accountable is a range of behaviors in which you take responsibility for the ways that you show up or don't show up. If I have a person now and she's like, doesn't want to be touched, has no interest in it, demeans the partner every time the partner takes the slightest initiative, for all kinds of reasons doesn't want to be touched, I understand it, but is waiting for the partner to go elsewhere so that that person can say, he or she cheated on me. And I am too privy to the games people play in their relationships to just adhere by a standard by which behind which people will hide when it isn't necessarily the truth. And if we're going to look for truth and for honesty, then we need to go for a different, more complex and more holistic kind of honesty.
There was something you wanted to read?
Yes, because I wrote about three outcomes, three, you know, the people who stay, the sufferers. They stay together, three groups of people who stay together in the aftermath of an affair or affairs. And one group, I call them the sufferers, the supplicants. They are together, but they are quite miserable. This has become the epicenter of their relationship. They talk about it all the time. It's kind of swallowing poison and waiting for the other person to die. You know, that's the definition of resentment. And then the second group, I think it's a 12-step line. It's not my original thought. And then the second group are the people who are kind of happy that that this insanity is moved on and that they can reconnect and regroup and go back with their life and be rational again and not be completely out of control and in this descent. And then there's the third group, which I call the explorers, because I learned a lot from them, because that's the group that allowed me to make that statement. Sometimes people come out of this experience better than they were before. That still doesn't mean I would recommend it. The explorers. I've been particularly interested in a third category of couples, those for whom the affair becomes a catalyst for transformation. These explorers come to see infidelity as an event that, though insanely painful, contains the seed of something positive. When faced with the collapse of the world they knew, these couples home in on each other with a level of intensity they haven't experienced in years. It's not uncommon for them to experience a combustive rekindling of desire that is a potent mix of anxiety and lust. Fear of loss is the spark plug that sets it off. They're deeply engaged, in pain, but alive. The explorers have taught me much about what lies at the core of resilient relationships. Madison and Dennis always struck me as being this kind of couple. The uncovering of his affair threw them into turmoil, but I remember noting during our sessions that they had an uncanny ability to express and accept a wide range of feeling without demanding premature closure. Their tolerance for ambiguity and uncertainty opened up a space for exploration in which they could more deeply reconnect. In contrast with the sufferers who conceive of their ideal in moral absolutes, the viewpoint of the explorers is more fluid. They more readily distinguish wrong from hurtful, paving a smoother road for clemency. Several years later, when I touched base with Dennis and Madison, they affirmed that they managed to sustain their wild swings without either of them marching off to a divorce lawyer. Their grief revealed new facets of themselves and each other. Their first marriage was over, and they would never get it back, but they could choose to have a second one with each other. In the process, they were able to turn the experience of infidelity into an enlarging emotional journey. When they speak about the affair, it is clear that they identify it as one event, not the definitive event in their long history together. One sign that they have successfully metabolized the events appears in their language, shifting from you and me to our. Madison doesn't talk about when you did this to me, rather they both talk about when we had our crisis, recounting a shared experience. Now they're joint scriptwriters sharing credit for what they produce. What started outside the relationship is now housed within. For Madison and Dennis, the affair has become a landmark integrated into the broader geography of their lives together. Above all, they know that there are no clear-cut answers, and they're able to discuss the betrayal with a fundamental acceptance of their human flaws. Madison and Dennis's relationship feels much richer and more interesting, but it also can feel less secure. They have added novelty to the enduring, mystery to the familiar, and risk to the predictable. I'm not sure where all of this is going to take us, but dull it certainly is not, Dennis says. If before they were facing dead ends, now they don't know where they will end up. But the very fact is more exciting than frightening, and they are in it together. To repair is to repair. There's a thing that... Is the mic doing something?
Sorry?
I thought the mic is doing noise like that.
Yeah, I didn't know what the clicking is. But okay. Is it possible to, in your office, take a couple who are the supplicants or the sufferers and turn them into the explorers?
I'll tell you, I had a couple that's actually going to be in the podcast, Where Should We Begin?, which are unscripted, anonymous, live couple therapy sessions. Not of my patients, but she goes to the doctor and comes back with an STI. And they found out about it not 9 months before they come to see me. So I'm not seeing them in the immediate crisis. There is a crisis phase, there is an insight phase, and there is a vision phase. It's kind of the way I lay out the work that I do with couples who want to see what are they going to do together or maybe not. And one thing that I noticed is in the midst of talking about how terrible it was and finding this out and what he didn't... And then 2 minutes later, they would talk about the shitty backgrounds they came from and how they had built this incredible family together and how he helped her with the alcoholic father and how she helped him with... And they had this uncanny ability to be furious, she, at him, and then after that talk about what a decent human being he was as a father, as a son, as a, you know, and the same, it was that ability to not see the person just as the sum total of all of that. Because in the midst of all of this, you know, you have people who completely disappear and they're just gone and they're irritable every time you talk and these are the signs kind of thing, right? But then you have people who in the middle of all of this are still going to visit your mother at a hospital every week and taking care of your alcoholic nincompoop brother and dealing with the family and providing and helping you write the book that you never could write.
Demonstrating their loyalty to you in so many other ways that don't just involve their genitalia.
Right. Loyalty and fidelity are not always the same thing. And so when people have that ability, you know that the prognosis is much better because there is a robust relationship behind it. When you take the sufferers, who sometimes you don't know why they are, they can't be with and they can't be without. And it's not always clear that it was so much better before. But the affair is one event that just demonstrates the paucity of resources in the relationship. Can you turn it around? It's not so easy. It's not, there are times when I have looked at a couple and, you know, I do this for 35 years. It's not an exact science, but I have a pulse. And there is a couple in the book because it was the first and only time I did this, where in the first half hour, I said, this is over. This is finished. Because
how did they react?
Well,
that's not what they were paying you for.
No, absolutely not.
They were there to be repaired.
I'm on the 22nd floor, and he would have thrown me out the window. And I completely understand it. But I knew, I have gone back to them 10 years later to ask them, what was it like for you that I did this? And I wrote about it. I had to shorten it, but I have all the letters. And because I was always curious, and now I had a reason to go and reach out to them. He had a father who cheated on his mother for years. He had promised himself he will never be like that guy. He will not leave the family. He will keep it together. He learned about his father through a friend of the mother who met him in the mall. This is about, you know, to tell or not to tell, you know. And he has a wife with whom he, till today, has a wonderful friendship. They've raised their son together, the whole thing. But I knew she was not going to touch him. She did not want to touch him. whatever the reasons, I think she never fully understood herself why. And I thought, you are going to be miserable. He was bursting out of his skin, begging her, love me, make love to me, be with me. And she couldn't do it. She was having the affair. And I thought, I need to set this man free. I need to set this man free from a promise that he made that wasn't his responsibility. And I said, you're done. So at first, he was like a loaded gun. And I said, can you put the gun in the drawer? Because, you know, and I held it. You hold this. You create calm, you create structure, you create reassurance. And I said to him, you are going to come through this. You will have a better life. You do not have to live like this. You do not have to be a beggar of love. You are an amazing guy. So is she. But this isn't going to change. I couldn't find in her the slightest motivation. And he thanked me and thanked me and thanked me. That's not to say this was the right thing. It's just that it's nice to know. It's just nice to know. They meet, they go to the games, they have lunch together, but they were not meant to be a couple.
One last question, and then we're going to take a little break. I'm often told that I put too much importance on sex.
You are a sex columnist.
Yeah, a sex columnist, right? Like a sports columnist who puts too much importance on scoring. And yet, the people who tell me that I place too much importance on sex, usually when we're having an argument about the fact that I will sometimes give people permission to go and cheat. I think there are circumstances under which cheating is the least worst option. I also think there are some cases, some relationships where someone has grounds to cheat. And they're not the victim of the affair, but they are indeed the victim of the marriage, a marriage they can't extricate themselves from without damaging their partner, and it might be better to stay and cheat. But what I often hear from people, I put too much importance on sex, and these people who say this to me are invariably the people who also say, if there was an infidelity, if someone cheated, you have to end the relationship. It is over. And what I say to them is, you tell me I put too much importance on sex, and I look at a marriage and I see family, children, a history together, property, two extended families knit together, a community, really a village of people who've come together because of this couple. And I look at all of that on one side of the scales and a blowjob on the other side of the scales, and I go, this weighs more than this. But the people who say I put too much importance on sex, they do this. They say that this blowjob is more important and carries more weight than all of this must be discarded because of this blowjob.
Okay, but that's because they're not thinking about the sex, actually. So I began this work. Actually, I began the work on mating in captivity. I kind of was inspired by the Clinton scandal. Why? Because lots of different things were interesting there. But one of the things that struck me in terms of how America can put adultery as a matter of national political agenda was that in this country, as you say, you can divorce 3 times. Nobody blinks an eye. There is massive tolerance for that dissolution and dismantlement of entire family systems.
You could be Newt Gingrich's adulterous partner and then become Donald Trump's ambassador to the Vatican in the case of Calista Gingrich. His third wife, his adulterous partner, ambassador to the Vatican. Anyway, please continue. I'm Catholic. I have a capacity to be shocked by that.
I'm going to continue where I was going. The thing that struck me is that the rest of the world that is, so basic tolerance, much tolerance for divorce, zero tolerance for transgression. But the rest of the world has always opted the other way around, especially when it is more family oriented. It has always made a compromise around the infidelities by the courtesy of women, let us be clear, in favor of the preservation of the family, in order not to have this dissolution take place. So when people put what you call the sex above, in America, people tell you it's not the sex, It's because he lied or she lied. It's the deception, it's the betrayal, it's the violation of the trust.
And you believe them when they say that? Because I think it's the sex.
I think that it varies, actually. But the interesting thing is, for me, how different it is. I've gone around the world asking these questions now since 2009. From Muslim countries to Christian countries to secular Europe, Western Europe, Southern Europe, South America, you know, Middle East. It's very interesting what people come with. Like, if I am in Argentina and I do an entire day of training on the subject with therapists from, and they have live stream to Ecuador, to Peru, and I go an entire day and nobody talks about lying. And I'm like, how is that possible? We're not talking about lying. In the States, this would be one of the first things, secrets and lies, is, and there is explanation. I can explain to you why. And they answer me because that, first of all, it's an obvious thing. If there is an infidelity, by definition, you're lying. That's kind of part of the territory. And the next thing they tell you is, we've been lying since the Spanish came around. You know, lying is not where they get all... Jealousy is the thing that is going to fire them up. Jealousy. Which in America, you can look at book after book about infidelity, especially the clinical books, there is no mention of jealousy. My colleague Michelle Shankman did an entire research on that. The jealousy does not appear because Americans are not jealous, they're angry. They replace it. Jealousy is not allowed in a pseudo-egalitarian model. You're not allowed to be jealous anymore. Right? So you can see themes that are culturally very central in one place and absent in another. Here, secrets are bad because the notion is that intimacy is into me see, and there is a tremendous value on transparency. Not keeping secrets is the full expression of how close we are.
Can any relationship survive transparency? I lie to my husband like 3 times before breakfast.
So, but here's the next thing. I'm happy to ask the audience tonight, you know, the dominant view is that lying is selfish, lying is self-interested, lying is bad. The concept that lying can be protective, that lying can actually be caring, that lying can actually be that a certain opaqueness is actually preferable to the kind of moral truth of candor, those are very culturally determined values. In many parts of the world, people think that lying can be caring. Here, this is blasphemous. You know, so you lie, you do small lies. It's the same thing when people say, I can't trust. Of course, people lie to their partners on all kinds of things. People also, when they say, I cannot trust you anymore, they still do. They still share the finances, they share the kid, the house isn't burned. They still trust them on a lot of things. They don't trust them on this, but they don't say, I don't trust you for that. They say, I can't trust you anymore. As if before they trusted them on everything. I never left the kids with him, I never left the car with her. There's so many things for which they didn't trust each other. But it goes in absolute. And that doesn't help us. It doesn't help us if we choose to stay, and it doesn't help us if we leave, because we then leave with these legacies that make it so much harder for us to love again.
All right, we're going to take a short break.
Thanks for streaming this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Tune in again soon.